Today we're going to talk a little bit about our personal philosophy of how we implement homeschool. We're not saying everyone has to do it just like us. We're saying this is how we do some things, and here are some of the reasons why we do what we do. Hopefully, as we go through some of this, you will get some ideas about some things you could do, maybe in a different way. Or maybe it'll spark some ideas that it gives you an idea, and you can use it or share it with someone else. So in terms of implementing homeschool, one of the things that needs to happen is there has to be a certain understanding of priorities. And as Rhoda mentioned to the ladies this morning, you know, obedience is very important for success. Sometimes parents say, well, what do you do if your homeschooled child will not do their homework? That is not a homeschool question. That is a parent question. The issue is obedience. And so it's not a homeschool problem, it's a parent problem. It sort of reminds me of a question that sometimes people ask, well, what do you do if you have a strong-willed child? Someone said one time, the problem is not the strong-willed child, it's the weak-willed mother. So have as a priority, first of all, that you will teach your children to obey. And after all, that is your moral obligation as a parent anyway. God says, children, obey your parents. Children, honor your parents. And if you as a parent are not requiring those two things of your children, you are undermining the moral authority of God in that child's life. So get that down and work on that. Make sure that that is foundational, because it will save you all kinds of hassle and difficulties, in addition to the fact that it's God's will for your child to obey, and it's God's will for you to teach him to obey. Furthermore, if you're going to be successful in homeschooling, you may need to sacrifice some of your own personal interests to make it work. That means, for example, that a wife might need to skip some other things, especially at the beginning, in order to have time. She might not have time to do any gardening. She might not have time to do much sewing. You know what you can do? Go to the Goodwill and buy some blouses, and you can make a few jumpers, and you can buy a whole bunch of blouses and save yourself a lot of time and a lot of money. You might not have time to do crafts. And you know, a lot of people are putting these little baskets around on the wall, and there's, what is it, some outfit out in Ohio, Lomberger baskets or something, they charge an astronomical price for those things, and some of these people are collecting that stuff. Well, you have to decide what your priorities are. You want Lomberger baskets in your house, or do you want to do something else that's more important? What about the husband? You know, a husband might need to learn that there are some things more important than growing the business. He might need to learn that hunting and fishing trips aren't very important. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to go hunting and it's wrong to go fishing. But you know, I wonder sometimes, with men that like to go hunting, would they be willing to spend the exact same amount of time that they've invested in purchasing their guns and their ammo and practicing and scouting out the land and seeing where the deer trails are and all those things, take that same amount of time and spend it building up their wife to be a more and more glorious person? Wonder where their priorities are. And I think there should be some husband involvement in homeschool. Now, in most cases, the major effort in homeschool becomes the effort of the wife. Many times a husband is not working at home, but there are things a husband can definitely do in terms of the implementation and the blessing of homeschool. One is to support your wife in what she is doing. Help her realize that what she is doing is more important than having the best cooked meals with stuff grown out of the garden. And that's what you want her to do instead of worrying about this. Listen to her when she tells about the things of the day that were frustrating in terms of implementing homeschool. And you can pray together with her. You can look over some of the children's work. Ask them to show you what they're doing. So you see, oh, I see you're learning this now. And you can do some of the teaching. You know, there are various women have spoken to Rhoda about how they feel inadequate in science or math. And sometimes their husbands will help do some of those kind of things in the evenings when they get home from work. Or maybe a husband can help check the math for younger children. I believe a husband can be involved in significant interaction and discussion with his wife regarding the curriculum. Why do we want to use this instead of using this? What are the advantages of this curriculum? Maybe we want to use a piece of this and a piece of this. And what kind of operating procedures do we use? Why should we do one thing or another? I believe that another area of husband involvement is that any affront to the mother is a serious affront to the father. My wife knows that if she has a hassle that is too much for her to handle, if she has a child that won't cooperate in discipline, or if she has some other problem that she isn't making any headway, she just says, listen, if you aren't willing to cooperate, I'm going to bring Father in here and he's going to deal with you. You know what that does? They change their mind. They decide it would be better to let Mother deal with this. I believe that husbands should let their wife know that any time a child is not cooperative, that is a big slap in Dad's face. Now, specifically in relation to materials, how do we implement homeschool? Our philosophy is that a child should read lots of books. Read biography. Read about scientific things. Read about historical events. Read, read, read. Do reading instead of filling out workbooks by the ton. I mean, workbooks, in my opinion, most of the time are busy work. You open up the workbook, you read this little paragraph, and then you've got 10 questions. Okay, what do they want for this one? What do they want for this one? What do they want for this one? You know, it's sort of like, look, 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 look. And the goal becomes filling in the blank instead of learning anything. They become adept at filling in blanks. I remember one time we were using some, in the earlier years, we were using some of this material, and we had a math book, and it had on the page 1 plus 1, 1 plus 2, 1 plus 3, 1 plus 4, 1 plus 5, 1 plus 6, 1 plus 7, 1 plus 8, 1 plus 9, 2 plus 1, 2 plus 2, 2 plus, you know. Well, the child looked at that thing and said, oh, I know how to do this. See what they're doing? Filling in the blanks. They saw the pattern? Do it. Don't use materials like that. Instead, have them read a lot. You know, reading, exposure to good books is going to do more for their education than any other one thing. And I believe that you should give them a slice from many subjects. That means academic and practical. You know, it is so easy for people to fall off the cliff on either side and miss the boat. There are some people who think academic things don't matter. Well, what we want is to teach our boys, you know, how to change a tire and how to drive a tractor and how to, you know, put on a metal roof or whatever. And, you know, well, practical, you know, sitting in class and reading a book and figuring out how to solve an algebra equation, that's not important. You know, that's a foolish attitude. But at the same time, if you have an attitude that your goal is to do all academics so that you can be like some woman out in Utah or somewhere that her children are finished with college level material by the time they're 16 and they're doing master's degrees by the time they're 18 and teaching in college by the time they're 20 or whatever, and that's what you're doing and you're going to school year round, maybe you're missing a boat too. You see, you can fall off either way. And I believe we need to have a slice of many different subjects. People need to learn some practical things, but they need to learn some academic things. You know, we are reaping a great famine in many of our churches because too many men did not know enough about intellectual things, and it hampers their preaching and their Bible study because they didn't study. They didn't learn how to study enough. And they get up and they say things that simply aren't true because they don't know enough. They're mistaken. There's ignorance going on. I believe we need to cultivate an attitude that says learning things from books and having your facts right are important. I know of one family who had a homeschool. Their daughter was an amazing seamstress. I mean, she could cut out a dress and put it together in a very short time. But, you know, she was ignorant. She was ignorant of what the word elevation meant. And ignorant of things of spelling and grammar. You see, either polarity is a serious deficiency. We want to learn the practical things, yes. We want to have our child know how to cook a meal, how to make a dress, how to care for a garden. But we want them to learn these other things too. We want a wide branch of things. You know, when they get out into life, what do we want? They get into a situation, oh, You know, it would really be helpful if I knew this. Well, I know this little piece of it because my mother and my father taught me a little bit, and they taught me how to find the rest of it. That's what we want. We need to get a basic level of expertise to get an adequate introduction. Now, Rhoda and I call this getting over the hump. For example, one of the things we do in our home is we want our children to learn a little bit about how to play a piano. Personally, I think that's a good exercise. They learn motor skills, coordination, and they learn to read abstract symbols off of a page and translate that into a musical sound. Well, now that takes a lot of coordination, a lot of intellectual activity really going on there to read these symbols, know to push this finger down here and this one here and push your foot at the same time and left hand is doing something else. You see, concentration, it's a good exercise, but they learn something useful in the process. And you know, often when a child is little, they like to do this for a little bit. And then they get to a point where it's more work than they thought it was going to be. You know what they want to do then? Quit. You know what we do? You can't quit. You've got to do it for a while yet. And so they have to have their piano practice, a half hour a day or whatever it is, and they have to do it and do it and do it. And then, after a while, something begins to happen. They get over the hump. And then it's, hey, I can make this thing do this. Hey, I can do this kind of thing. That sounds neat. And this song, I have this song that I'm playing. And now if I take the first part and put it in the left hand instead of in the right hand and do this the other way, look how that sounds. It makes it different. That's neat. You see what's happening? They're beginning to internalize some of this that they had to do because you said you have to have a little bit of skill. And then they get over the hump. And it begins to feed itself. And so they want to try this new song. And they find out this song, I can play this song now. You see, various subjects are like that. You have to have a certain basic expertise in them before they're any fun. You know, it isn't too much fun to read if you got to sit down and have 5 seconds for every word you're going to read, is it? That's not much fun. But when you really get to the point where that's just a message flying off the page into your brain, and there's all these exciting things that are going on that page that transport you to another world, then is when reading is fun. And so now you aren't just reading a book. You are walking in the time of when Daniel Boone was going back in here in Yadkin County doing something, dodging Indians, I guess. You see, you're transported by the fact that you're sitting there reading this page and it's going into your mind. Well, that's getting over the hump. And I believe we need to have a well-rounded balance of subject matter, not just bits and pieces of information. You know, sometimes there are fads that come along and people say, well, what we do, we just base our curriculum on character. You know, we'll just do a character study. And anything we think of about character, then we'll try to think, well, how does this affect law and medicine and math and all this kind of stuff? So they have little tidbits of information. But listen, can they solve an algebra equation? Can they write a composition that's really worthwhile? You see, yes, I'm glad for them to get information on lots of different things, but you need to have enough coherent information on one subject that you can have some competence in that subject. I think there needs to be a balance between academics and character. You know, some people say, well, we're not concerned about academics. We're concerned about character. As if you have to be concerned about this one or this and not both. I'm concerned about both, aren't you? Because I want my child to be able to do things in addition to the fact that I want him to have a good character. I mean, are you going to say, well, forget about making tents. Don't worry about how to make tents. Just focus on character. That'd be wrong, wouldn't it? So we need to have both. So what do we use for curriculum? Well, I think some of you have gathered, we do not use a paste kind of curriculum. We did use this at first. We were in a situation where we were a satellite school of an existing school and they wanted us to use their curriculum, so we did. We found we had various problems, and so we eventually weeded it all out. We don't use any paste curriculum. It's the kind of thing where it's fill in the blanks, and it does not stimulate creative learning. It stimulates getting the workbook filled out. We're going to look for the answer that the author wants. And you know, here's what happens. Your child looks at this and they, I don't know how to answer this question. So the parent looks at the question, and then they look back at the paragraph. They say, I don't know what they want either. Let's look in the answer book. So you look in the answer book, and how'd they get that answer? That seems sort of strange. Well, why'd they want that? You know what? The focus has gone totally in the wrong place. After all, we live in a society that thinks that somebody else has to write an answer book so we know whether we've done something right. Isn't there something wrong with that? We need to be able to figure out whether the thing we're doing is right or not. And so, incidentally, if you have a math book, you don't have to have a book of answers. I mean, if you have an algebra equation, use an algebra equation to solve a word problem, how do you check your answer? You don't check the answer by plugging it into the equation. You check your answer by saying, okay, suppose it's this. Now let's fit it into the word problem and see if it works. And if it fits into the word problem and gives you the answer that makes sense in the word problem, then you know you've done your algebra right. You see, you can prove to yourself whether or not your answer is right. But now really, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing in life? Being able to prove to ourselves that our answer is right. We don't have formal science or history before grade 3 or 4. Instead, we have the children read from books in the library. We don't think you should get bogged down with teachers' manuals. I mean, you know, these teachers' guides, they are guides. They are not your master. Have any of you ever been in school and when you got to the end of the year, you hadn't covered the entire book? Yes. Guess what? As a homeschooling parent, you don't have to cover the entire book either. You can look at it and say, you know, if they get through all these chapters, this chapter may be interesting, and sometimes if they have time, they can come back and look at it if they want, or if they need to later, they can study this if they want, but we're not going to make an issue of that in the school year. One of the things we do is, instead of having grammar books that the children slog through, we have them do lots of compositions. I am not so concerned about whether a child can tell me the definition of a gerund. How many of you ever heard that word, a gerund? Okay, it's a grammatical term. When I was in school, in high school, I had grammar lessons. And you know, we had these workbooks to fill out, and you'd diagram sentences, and you'd name parts of speech, and what a gerund was, and all that stuff. And you know, I was good at it. It was easy. But you know something? I don't know what a gerund is today. I can't remember. But I know how to write something. I know what makes good writing. You see, you can have people that learn these technical things about English and don't know how to use English in an effective and powerful way. So we give compositions. I'll give you an example of a composition we gave one time. Remember the story of Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob wanting the blessing? And when Rebekah heard what Isaac had said to Esau, she said to Jacob, "Do what I tell you." Remember that story? So we gave an assignment. What if, instead of going through that deception that Rebekah and Jacob engineered, they would have gone off to another tent and prayed? How could the story have ended? Write another ending to that story. How would it have worked? Now, what has to happen? A child has to think. Has to think, oh, okay, they're not going to deceive. They're praying to God to intervene to fulfill God's promise. Now, remember, God's promise was the older will serve the younger. And Rebekah was concerned about that, and Isaac was carnal. He was determined to have Esau be the head of the family in direct contradiction to the revealed will of God. And that's a whole sermon idea in itself. But he was determined to violate what God had already revealed years earlier. So now what if Rebekah and Jacob had gone off to another tent and just prayed that God would intervene to stop Isaac from doing this thing against God's will? Shall I just leave it there and not tell you what some of the ideas were? You want to use it yourself? I'll give you some ideas. Well, one of the children said that they wrote a story, and the idea was that Esau got confused when he prepared the herbs for the stew, and it made it taste terrible instead of taste good. So then Isaac wasn't in a mood for blessing when he got this food. Another one, another suggestion that you could make would be that what the Lord could do is have the deer barely escape when he saw his hunting. Now, you know, that's what wears hunters out. You're out hunting and you see this deer. So you say, oh, I know, if I go up that way behind those rocks, around those trees, I'll get a good shot. So you get up there and you're just ready to release the shot, and something spooks the deer. And he runs off, and you think, oh, I've run in this country. I know exactly where he's going. He's going down that trail, down this way, down that little ravine. He'll come out of this other place. If I go around, way around this way, come around this way, I'll be there where he comes out. So you go running up in those hills, down those hills. And remember, Israel has a very rugged topography. So God is wearing Esau out. So he gets down there. Sure enough, that deer comes along, and he's just ready to make his kill, and something spooks that thing again. His hand slips, and the arrow goes wrong. And then he sees the thing go, and he knows, I'll never have any hope getting that one. So he's turning around, walking another way, and then he sees another one way off. So he thinks, okay, I can get that one. And he goes through that procedure. God could keep Esau busy for 3 or 4 days and wear the guy to a frazzle. Now, do you see what I'm getting at? The child has to use some creativity. How could this story have been different? But it also has spiritual insight in it. You know, so many times we fail because we end up saying, well, it'll never work. God can't solve this problem. That was really Jacob and Rebekah's problem. They viewed God as too small. They figured they had to help God out. They figured they had to violate God's principles in order to fulfill God's promises. But isn't that a temptation we're tempted with many times? Violate a principle in order to fulfill God's promise. And you see, then the child begins to think about this. So they've got to write this into coherent composition. They've got to take these ideas and make it into an interesting story. It's a great exercise. It's worth more than a ton of grammar books. What kind of focus do you want to have in your school? We want an idea that learning is fun. You know, academic games are just as much fun as physical games. I mean, is it more fun to play ball or is it more fun to play chess? Might depend on your inclination, but what I'm saying is you can have just as much fun with an academic type game, and ordinarily chess isn't viewed as an academic game, but you know, games where you're playing with your little child and having them learn the letters on the blocks, like Rhoda was describing this morning. That can be a game. That can be just as much a game as rolling a ball toward them on the floor. Remember, if you want learning to be fun, don't do things that create a situation where it is not fun. I know of a family who decided that they would have a child read. Whenever a child read a book, he would have to write a book report on that book. What do you suppose happened? The child quit reading. I mean, if I had to write a book report on every book I read, I'd quit reading too. But you don't want to do that. You say you write a book report on certain books, possibly, but you want the child to read. Don't create a situation where it is going to be counterproductive to read. We have art at home. A lot of it is self-taught. Children teach themselves how to draw. Just give them a piece of paper and say, draw yourself a picture and color it. But then we also have gotten these art books that some of you have seen where they have different stages of different pictures to get a child the idea of you start with this simple sketch and then you fill it in and make it more and more detailed. We have the idea that learning can be fun, but we also have the belief that learning must be done even if it doesn't happen to be fun to that child. I mean, that always happens. You know, life is that way. There are things that we do that in general we enjoy, but there are aspects of it we don't enjoy. But we do the part anyway, don't we? Because it needs to be done. And a child has education that's remiss if he is allowed to only do the things that he likes to do and skip the ones he doesn't like. Well, I don't think this algebra will ever do me any good. Why do I have to learn this stuff? Well, I'm so sorry that you're so short-sighted about things, but you don't have a decision on that point. You need to learn this. You learn it because it may have some advantage to you sometime in the future that you don't even know about yet. Our philosophy in terms of homeschool is to be a tutor as much as possible. Now, in the early grades, when you're teaching a child how to read, that is a much more intensive situation. But as we move up into the higher levels, our goal is to get ourselves out of a job as fast as we can. I tend to operate in a tutorial kind of mode. I deal with some subjects that Rhoda doesn't deal with that much. Geometry, calculus, physics, New Testament Greek, some of those kind of things. And basically, the way I do is I say, here's the book. Read the chapter. Work maybe the odd-numbered exercises. Come to me if you have a question. That's my lecture. And you see, the goal is, I want that child to be able, on any subject, to be able to say, you know, I need to learn something about this subject. Go to a standard library and pick up a book on that subject and read it and understand it. And you know, most subjects do not have some kind of ACE type structured lesson plan at a library for you to pick up and learn about that subject. It's going to be in a regular book. And so that's another reason why I don't approve of that kind of structured lesson. I think it's counterproductive in terms of developing a mentality in terms of how to learn things. We do not go through a lot of detailed lesson plans. You know, sometimes people try to run their homeschool in a similar way to that they've seen a traditional classroom run. And if you do it that way, you're going to have problems. Like I mentioned, I do tutorial type things, like in Greek, for example, and you have to be flexible. For the first several children, what I used for the first child, I used a book by J. Gresham Machen. It's just a standard seminary textbook on New Testament Greek. And I said, here, read this. Work the exercises and come to me if you have a question. And so I didn't give tests. I just opened up the book and say, translate this sentence. And I could tell whether that child could do it. And then one of the things I did with the next two children that came along, I decided I'm going to have them do this together. So I said, all right, now what you do is you do these exercises. Here are these Greek sentences you're supposed to translate into English. When you get them translated, then you compare your answer with your brother or sister and have a debate among yourselves as to who is right. Now you see what that does? They have to say, oh, this is what I put. What'd you put? That's not the same. Well, who's right? Now they have to have a little discussion to decide who would be correct. And then after you've had your discussion, then you both come to me. So you know what would happen? I would ask one of them to say what they translated. They said, well, I translated this, but the other person is right. Do you see what was happening? They had learned that really the reasons that person gave for why they translated were better than the ones they had for translating some other way. Be ready to change as a parent. You know, I was down in Dallas, and I wasn't really satisfied with some of the materials I had for some of this Greek. And so I was talking to somebody down there, and they told me, yeah, I could go over to Dallas Seminary and look at their bookstore and such a book that might be useful. So I went over there and looked around. Ended up buying a different book that we use now for some of the children. So I've, it can be a case of where one child can learn better with this book, and another child can learn better with this book. That's fine. And what does that teach a child? There are times you'll go pick up a book to learn something, and it just doesn't seem to make sense to you. What can you do to help yourself? Go to a library, find another book on the same subject that approaches it from a little different way, and maybe that'll be clearer to you. And then you can go back to your first book, and you find, oh, now I see what they're saying, and the first book has some insights that the second book didn't even have. That's what you want your children to learn. If you want to get your children to dig into material, be a person who digs into material yourself. Where truth is the goal. Let me ask you something. will you as father or mother change when you are shown to be wrong? If you are not willing to change when you're shown to be wrong, you cannot expect your children to change when they're shown to be wrong. Now let me give you an example. I remember one time we had company. A friend was over at our house for supper. And in the course of the conversation at the table, one of my children said to me, "Why is it that if you make a paper airplane out of a napkin, it won't fly? Out of a paper napkin." And I said, "Well, maybe it's because, you know, there are molecules of air that, you know, a napkin is sort of bumpy, and there are molecules of air that hang on to the bumpiness of the paper, and that sort of makes drag, and so it just doesn't want to fly very good." And then the child said, "Oh, so if I'd make it out of construction paper, would it fly?" Gotcha. You see what happened there? That's got some bumpiness to it, but it would fly. Everybody knows it would fly. What's the issue? It's not the bumpiness. What is it? Stiffness. Not the weight. It's the stiffness. See? Now, what if you just said, "Well," tried to make some kind of nice sounding gobbledygook so that the visitor wouldn't be impressed that you didn't know what you were talking about? Well, he probably would have figured out that you didn't know what you're talking about anyway. And guess what? You'd have lost a lot of credibility with your child. You know, a lot of people are more concerned about their reputation than they are concerned about reality. And if you want your child to really learn, you've got to be able to say, "Yes, I was mistaken." You know, one of the things that I've done with some of the children is tutored them in calculus and physics. I remember one child I was tutoring in physics. This child came to me. This was after, you know, they had done their high school work, and the child said, I said to him, "What do you want to study now?" And this child said, "Well, you know, languages are fun to me. Maybe I should study something I don't like math and physics." I thought, "Well, that's a good idea. Good exercise." So we went through some calculus, enough calculus to have what's called elementary differential and integral calculus, and then that gives you enough background to do some elementary physics. Well, this child came one day with a problem in the physics book. And the problem really is a simple problem. Suppose you have a balloon up in the air, and there's a little basket, and there's a weight in the basket of a certain amount of mass, and because the weight is in the basket, the balloon is descending through the atmosphere at a certain rate. How much of that weight do you have to throw out so that balloon will ascend at the same rate? Now, obviously, that's a deterministic problem. Shouldn't be too hard. And it's a problem that fits in with calculus that should be pretty straightforward. I looked at that problem, and I thought about that problem, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I could not solve the problem. Now, what are you going to do when you have a situation like that? You're going to spend the next day solving that one problem about this balloon and throwing weights out of it? I'm not. You know what I said to the child? "I don't know how to solve a problem right now. Just go on." I mean, after all, in understanding physics, is it going to matter if they don't understand how to solve that particular one problem? What's the answer? No, it's not critical. So some days went by, and you know, this bothered me. I didn't like it that I couldn't solve this problem. So one night, about 10 o'clock at night, I got that problem back out. And you know what? It was easy. I solved it. It was easy. Now, I don't know what was wrong with my brain that I couldn't solve it the first time, but it was an easy problem. You know, sometimes that'll happen to your child too. You might struggle with a problem, and they can't get it. And you say to yourself, does the solution to this math problem, is that critical, absolutely critical to the understanding of this math topic? And if the answer is no, say, then forget it. Just leave it alone. Go on to the next thing. They might try it a week later and find that somehow something has settled into place in the right crannies up there that makes the problem understandable and solvable. You know, I remember that after I had Rochelle go through some of this stuff in physics, we stopped at a church out in northern Indiana. If you drive Route 30 west out of Warsaw, Indiana, on the left-hand side, you eventually come to a church that's facing right onto Route 30. And years ago, our family gave a seminar at a church where a certain man was a pastor, and this pastor was an artist. And so they had a baptistry in the church, and what he did was he had a picture back there of stream and trees and stuff like that, so it looked like you were at the stream. You'd pull back the curtains, and there you were at the baptistry, but it looked like you were at the stream. This fellow was an artist, and he had decided it would be neat to have a church where there would be a statue in the vestibule of David and Goliath. So they built a new church, and they put it right beside Route 30 with big glass windows facing Route 30. And on the outside it says, Jesus is Lord, and with God all things is possible, or something like that. And then there is David with his sling and Goliath up there. And it's all lit up at night with lights so that all the trucks that are going by Route 30 can see this David and Goliath statue right inside this church. Well, I knew that church was going to be built, and so, you know, we stopped in there one time after it was built. Just look at that thing. And Rochelle was looking at it with the way the statue was. She said, you know something? David is not positioned right. If he would be throwing that rock like that, the rock would go out the window. It wouldn't go toward Goliath. You see, she had studied enough about physics to know that with how this would come around, it would have to go the wrong way. Now, the guy who designed the statue, he was an artist. He wasn't thinking about physics. So he got that part goofed up. But you see, in an unexpected way, this study of calculus and physics enhanced the understanding of art. And so, like, if you were illustrating something for someone, maybe a Bible story book, maybe you should know a little physics. That's just an idea. A lot of people think that in order to learn anything, you have to have some teacher teach you. It just isn't true. We need to develop an attitude that you can dig things out for yourself and you can learn them. So many people are hampered by the notion that they've got to take a course in order to learn something. One of the things we want to do in terms of the focus of our school is to teach our children to think. And one of the ways to do that is to seek out significant discussions with thinkers. Have discussions with other adults. Someone said, small minds talk about people. Average minds talk about things. Great minds talk about ideas. There's a lot of truth to that. Evaluate the size of your mind by that little sieve. Visit with people. Visit with people who think and who will discuss ideas. Rhoda mentioned this morning about conversations we had when we visited a physicist who had worked at Goddard Space Flight Center. You know, when you talk with people like that, they say things that jostle the mind and open up new vistas of understanding or new questions. Hey, I never thought about that. I wonder about that. Maybe that has something that can be applied over here. Read lots of mind-challenging material. One of the books that we've had some of our children read is a book titled Gödel, Escher, Bach. Gödel, umlaut O-D-E-L, was a mathematician. Escher was a famous artist, and if you've ever seen his art, it's really neat. He'll have there's a famous picture that he drew where he has birds, white birds flying in a black background in one direction, and he does it so cleverly that the backgrounds of the birds become the birds going the other way, flying into the light. So it's day and night, and it's symmetrical. He does all kinds of really clever things like that. And then Bach, of course, was the great musician. And the person who wrote this book is tying together ideas from music and from science and from math and from art and all kinds of things. And it's a book that stimulates the mind. It helps you see connections between things that you hadn't thought of. giving your children exposure to a book like that can be worth some time. I believe another thing to do in teaching our children to think is to have lots of discussions and debates. Sit around the table and have a discussion on something. Have a discussion on, say, a certain verse and why this verse is difficult for the Arminians. And then turn around and have a discussion on another verse why it's difficult for the Calvinists. You know, have a discussion on all kinds of topics. They can be theological topics. They can be on the pros and cons of why green paint is better than on a tractor than orange or red. You know, whatever. People have different interests. But you can have all kinds of discussions. Let me give you an example of a discussion that we had at our table one time. And this example that I'm going to read to you is actually an excerpt out of Rochelle's journal that she wrote when she was about 13 years old. Now, so what you can see a little bit is one of the things I encouraged Rochelle to do, she was our first child and we tried out lots of things, was write a journal. Now, don't write a journal just of what happened during the day, but write a journal about what you think. Write a journal about how you think about things. And so she has written lots and lots of journals, and of course, she's developed to be a very good writer, and now that she's over in Nigeria, when we get a letter from her, she's ordinarily not in contact with us because she's out in the village where there's no email and there's no phone and there's no electricity. But when she goes into the city, then she can transmit her journal of the last 5 weeks. So we get an email like that, and it's a great event at our house. But anyway, here's an excerpt of a journal that's describing a mealtime discussion that we had. We have been discussing planes and bullets and speeds and relativity and gravity and equations and imaginary numbers and rectangular matrices and decimals and infinity and elevators and trains and throwing balls backwards and forwards and upwards and downwards and light and stars and space and the universe. Father is the scientist, I am the skeptic. And very skeptical I am, to be sure. All my comfortable theories and suppositions about my neat and orderly little universe are crashing down about my ears, and it is not easy to change the scope of thought one has used all one's life. To tell the truth, I am beginning to feel like a 16th century Catholic confronted suddenly with a bunch of strange and unconventional ideas to turn the whole world topsy-turvy. It all started when Rowland announced that American scientists are working on a new plane that will be able to go twice the speed of a bullet. But of course, that plane won't be able to have guns on it, Rowland remarked, because if it would shoot a bullet out the front of the plane would quickly catch up to the bullet and get shot. What do you think, you other children? Father questioned. Is that how it would work? The answering nods were unhesitating and unanimous. Such a simple matter was easy to see through. Father shook his head. Just think a little bit. How fast is that bullet going before it's shot? It's not moving at all, declared Rowland. Wrong, answered Father. Anyone else know? The same speed that the plane's going, I suggested cautiously. In my head, I knew that that must be true, and yet, logical though that conclusion was, it seemed to defy all reason. Right, Father agreed. Let's call the speed of a bullet X. Then this plane, which flies at twice the speed of a bullet, travels at what? 2X, I responded. Good. So if the bullet is already going 2X before it's shot, and the bullet travels at X, right, how fast will the bullet go? 1x, 1.5x, 2x, and other ridiculous mutterings skittered uncertainly back and forth across the table. The way to solve the problem would, of course, be to add x to 2x and get 3x. However, the very idea of a bullet going 3 times its normal speed just because it happened to have been shot out of an airplane seemed ridiculous. Finally, however, I mentioned 3x as the answer and found to my disgust, dismay, and puzzlement that I was right. Immediately, therefore, I began to contradict myself and argue that the thing was not possible. No, it was possible, and the bewildered contents of my bursting cranium could not sort out a good enough argument to prove the wonder incorrect. But upon some reflection, I realized that the idea was not so mad as it had first appeared and was soon settling this funny fact into one of the neat piles of the information in my brain about our world. Then came the shocker. Father said, "Now, what if you are flying at 2X and fire a bullet out of your tail gun? What will happen to the bullet?" Well, nobody knew the answer. Finally, everyone gave up. When he gave the answer, what small remains were left of our ordered conventional reason evaporated in the heat of the idea. The bullet, Father answered, announced calmly, would follow the plane at 1X. Horrified silence and then an explosion of wild protests. End of quote. Now, all of our mealtime discussions are not that technical. You know, sometimes it's don't talk with your mouth full. Don't interrupt the other person. Various kind of things. But listen, you can have significant discussion at your mealtime if you want to. And the topics can be as broad as your interests are. But you notice what happens here? The goal is truth. You see, are you willing to jettison your comfortable little ideas? This whole story about the airplane erupted into a situation where people had to believe something that was totally different from what they thought. Now, are you willing to throw away all of your previous opinions when you're shown that you're wrong? You know something? A lot of adults have never learned how to do that. They're too proud to do it. We need to raise up a generation of children who love the truth and are willing to follow the truth wherever it leads. I believe that another way of teaching children to think, I personally like to have our children go through a course in high school plane geometry. Now, one of the reasons for that is plane geometry has lots of simple proofs that can be done. If you have a triangle and it has two sides that are the same, that's called an isosceles triangle. Now, can you prove that those two base angles will actually be equal to each other? You can draw pictures of it and you can see that's how it's going to work, but can you prove it using various axioms and theorems of geometry? And you see, what does a child have to do? They can see the problem. They can see, I have this much information. How do I get from this point to this point? It's a simple proof of something, reasoning from a simple set of facts. That's a great exercise. You know, a lot of people have never learned to logically take the essential elements and proceed to a conclusion. I think it's a great exercise. Another game, mathematics is a game in a sense. But another game that you can play that's a great exercise is chess. I'll tell you one of the reasons I like chess. There is no bad luck in chess. I mean, you know, you play Monopoly and you get this card that says, go sit on boardwalk or something. You know, so many of these games, you're stuck. I mean, you couldn't help yourself. Well, if you have a bad situation in chess, there is one reason you have it. It's because you made dumb moves to get there. So what you can do is you can learn a few things and do better the next time. And what is chess? How does chess work? You say, oh, I think maybe I'll go there. And then you think, but if I go there, he'll go here. And then I'll have to go here. And then he'll go here and I'll lose my rook. That's not good. I don't think I'll go there. What's the child learning? Consequences. Learning to think ahead. Learning to anticipate what the opponent might do. It's a good exercise. Have discussions about something somebody said. You know, sometimes people will get up, even in church, and say things that aren't appropriate. And your child might ask you about it. Then have a discussion and say, well, what do you think about it? What can you learn? One of the things we do is sometimes we give our children riddles. How about this one? Can you answer this riddle? Alive without breath, as cold as death. Never thirsty, ever drinking. Clad in mail, never clinking. How about this one? Round as a rainbow, teeth like a cat. Guess 7 years, you'll never guess that. Or this one. High as a house, low as a mouse. Bitter as gall, sweet after all. Anybody know the answers to those? Well, let me read the first one again. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsty, ever drinking. Clad in mail, never clinking. Second one. Round as a rainbow, teeth like a cat. Guess 7 years, you'll never guess that. The third one. High as a house, low as a mouse. Bitter as gall, sweet after all? The last one, the answer is a walnut. High as a house, low as a mouse. Bitter as gall, the outer shell, sweet after all, inside. You see, you've got to think about something in a way you aren't used to thinking about it, right? How could it be high as a house and low as a mouse? How could it be bitter as gall and sweet after all? Then you start putting things together. The other one, round as a rainbow. Blackberry bush, teeth like a cat. See? Blackberry stalk. Or the first one, a fish. Alive without breath, as cold as death. Never thirsty, ever drinking. Clad in mail, never clinking. See, you think about things in a different way. One of the things we like to do is give our children brain teasers. Rhoda talked about this a little this morning. Can you do this one? I'll draw four dots on this board. Can you connect all four of those dots with two straight lines and not lift your ink pen from the paper? And you can't cheat, you know, say, Two straight lines, and don't lift, you know, one, two. Oops, I didn't connect that one. Well, one, two. How do you do it? You know what a lot of people say to themselves almost right away? Can't be done. It can't be done. You know what the problem is? Frame of reference is too small. You're thinking like this. Got to think bigger. You see, that is so typical. Most faulty thinking occurs because a person's frame of reference is too small. They're looking at the problem like this instead of like this. How about this one? Let's see if you can do some arithmetic in your head. Let's suppose that a hunter left his camp and went hunting. He hiked 1 mile south, then 1 mile west, then 1 mile north, and he arrived at the same spot, and he shot a bear. What color was the bear? Yes?
White.
White. Polar bear. He had to start where?
At the North Pole.
At the North Pole. Okay, now since that was so easy, where else on the earth could he start and go 1 mile south, 1 mile west, 1 mile north, and end at the same spot? Where else besides the North Pole can you go 1 mile south, 1 mile west, 1 mile north, and end up at the same spot? Someone mumbled equator. That won't work because 1 mile south, 1 mile west, and you're 1 mile west when you get up to the equator. That won't do. In fact, to make this problem more interesting, it turns out that there are an infinite number of points on the earth where this can be done. Not just one more. There are an infinite number. And for you back there that have studied some engineering, in fact, there are an infinite number of infinite sets of points that this can be done at. Now, you see what that does? This problem seems so simple to start with. Now it seems like it's getting more complicated, and people are saying, how can that be? Some people are probably saying, that can't be done. But it can be. If I would tell you the answer, then you'd say, oh, well, yeah. I'll let you think on that one. How about this one? Let's suppose the earth was a perfect sphere. And you took a wire and put it around the equator, right against the earth. And then you took 6 feet more of wire and added it to the wire. Then you took posts and put them up above the earth to hold this thing equal distant away from the earth because you made more length. What size animal could crawl under the wire? A tick, or a mouse, or a groundhog, or a bull moose? Let's hear it. I hear some whispered ticks.
Bull moose.
Okay, you know what I can tell right away? All of you so far are guessing. You're just guessing. Now, certainly you know the formula for the circumference of a circle. So that ought to be a clue on how to begin. But you see, people look at this, and what a lot of people say is, well, I don't even know if a tick could get under there. Maybe it has to be a chigger, they might say. They're from the South. The answer is it'd be a groundhog. And that problem is easy to solve, and in fact, it is independent of the size of the Earth. If you put a wire around the circumference of the Earth's orbit around the sun with a 93 million mile radius and added 6 feet to the wire, it would stick out about a foot farther all the way around. It's independent of the size of the object you're doing it about. You know what a lot of people say in their minds when I say a thing like that? Pah, that can't be. I was at a church one time and I made that comment, so the pastor went home and he figured it out and he did some examples on the calculator because he didn't believe it. Then, well, yes, it is true. It is true. You can prove it, that it's arbitrary to the size of the object. But you see what this does? It helps a child learn that things are often not like they seem. You know, many times people think something is obviously true when it is in fact false. In fact, in the last few years I've been doing a lot of study on the book of Revelation. One of the things I've been thinking about is when you study Revelation chapter 12 and 13, you know, chapter 12 you have this war in heaven, and chapter 13 you have this stuff about the beast, the Antichrist. From the earth's vantage point, it looks like the devil is getting the upper hand from the earth's vantage point. I mean, the beast is in control and he's doing all these terrible things and the saints are getting killed. But what has happened? Actually, he has just been cast out of heaven. The devil's been cast out of heaven. So you see, from the earth's vantage point, it looks like the devil is getting the upper hand. Actually, he has lost a major component of his operations. You see, that's an example of how things often are not as they seem. And I believe one of the things we want to do is teach our children to think and help them to realize often things are not as they seem. Look carefully. Think deeply. Let's see, this is a little bit of an aside right now. Rhoda had mentioned this morning about a book that the children had written. It's of missionary stories, and what they did was illustrate it with pictures. This is an example of one of the things we do is with projects that have a use in themselves. In other words, it's not just a project for the sake of having a project. The third story in this book is about a fellow named Sadhu Sundar Singh, who was a believer over in India or Pakistan. And so they wrote it in poetic form with words that end in shun. It goes like this. Over craggy desolations, through dense words and heathen nations, strode a man whose name was Sadhu Sundar Singh. Sundar was of Sikh extraction, but he left his godless faction and forsook his wealth to follow Christ his king. Sundar had an urgent mission, living out the Great Commission, first in India, his country, then abroad. Braving cold and deprivation, thieves and snakes and isolation, he pursued the work to which he had been called. At a lofty elevation in a windswept mountain nation, Sundar Singh and a Tibetan trudged one day. Far from any destination, they came near to desperation when a storm came swirling down to bar their way. Then they had a debate because they saw someone down here who was in need of help. And the one man wanted to leave him there. Sundar decided, we better go help him out. So they're having a debate, and the debate they put in here in imaginary form. The one fellow is saying, don't do it. He says, you must be crazy, Sadhu Singh. I've a nagging premonition. This is our last expedition, and we'll die for sure if we do such a thing. You should learn to have compassion, Sundar said in sternest fashion, for unless we help this man, he'll surely die. If we leave for trepidation, he will die in isolation. Don't you think that saving him is worth a try? No, it's certain ruination, cried the friend in aggravation. Would you rather have three die instead of one? Listen to my last petition. Do you think in his condition he could still survive when all is said and done? Also, take consideration. You've been called to preach salvation. It would not be right to throw your life away. It would be a great transgression if you flouted all discretion. Hush, said Sundar. These are foolish things to say. Pious-sounding explanations are perverse abominations when we know what God would really have us do. With such brash repudiation, you may end in degradation, but you may decide. The choice is up to you. So anyway, I believe that if you want your children to write, you've got to have them read, and read literature that's good literature. If you want them to draw pictures that are good, then have them looking at books that have good pictures in them. Because the kind of thing that they're exposed to is the kind of thing that they will emulate. How do you implement these things? One is, do not be swayed by educational fads. You know, a lot of the old material, without all the bells and whistles, can do the job just as well. And you know, it's reusable. I mean, one of the books that we use for geometry is a book that I used many years ago, and it's very similar to the book that I had geometry in when I was in high school. If you go to a homeschool convention, and you see all these marvelous workshops, and all these booths where they have all this material that's just the latest and the greatest, and it's just the key to getting your child to understand math without any effort at all and to like it, be careful. Say, write down lots of these good ideas. Don't go buying up all this stuff you think is great. Because if you try to implement all that stuff in 1 year, you won't even be able to implement it all. Go and get lots of ideas. Write down the product name, the price, where you can get it. Come home, discuss it with your spouse. Think about it. Compare prices where you can buy it from other sources. And then make your purchases wisely. Don't try to do too much at one time. And remember, when you implement homeschool, the goal is competency. The goal is not the steps in getting there. And that means don't be judgmental toward other people that use different approaches. You know, some people don't have the same inclinations you do, and so they're going to implement it in a different way that works better for them. Well, God bless them. Let them do it. Don't be judgmental of them. And furthermore, don't be threatened by other people who do things differently from how you do them. I mean, just because someone else does a certain thing, that doesn't mean necessarily that you have to do it that exact same way. And thirdly, don't be too proud to seek advice or help. You know, pride gets in the way of a lot of things, doesn't it? And be flexible. Be willing to modify your approach. Now, why don't we pause for a time of questions or observations that you'd like to make. Anyone want to raise some questions? You know, somebody said maybe I'll answer all the questions before the session. People were talking to me about various things. And maybe what I've done in the session is even raised more questions. So here's your opportunity to ask a few more if you like. Okay, the question is, what made me want to use those brain teasers and how did I even know they existed? Well, I was interested in brain teasers even as a boy. So, you know, I would have gotten books out of the library when I was a boy with those kind of questions in them. And then, you know, over the years when you encounter certain ones, you find interesting things that bring out interesting facets of things. But I like to use them because it helps jostle the mind. It helps you think in a bigger picture than what you're accustomed to thinking in. I think that's an important exercise for people. Just in that vein, there is another story that I like to tell sometimes, and I debate about doing it in terms of helping people understand a little bit about infinity. It's the story of the infinite hotel. And sometimes I discuss it with my family, and they say, don't tell this story, because all it does is confuse people. And they get so hung up on the details of the story, they never can understand the point. So probably I'm not going to tell you the story. I'm just going to tell you that there is such a story that helps you understand infinity, but if I told it to you, many of you would say, yes, but what about this? And some people will react to it, and when I explain the answer in terms of how infinity works, they'll say, This is nonsense. You know why people say that? Because they don't really understand it. See? And so often, we have that kind of situation in life, and it's not on a situation about a story of an infinite hotel that doesn't really matter. It's about something that matters, but they are too proud to open their mind and say, oh, I haven't been thinking properly. I need to change my attitude. So I think a brain teaser type thing and these type of things can be wonderful in terms of helping us understand that our understanding is incomplete. You know, if you know this much, if you know something that can be represented by a circle 3 inches in diameter, how much do you know that you don't know? You only realize that you don't know this stuff here. But what if you know this much, a circle that's 15 inches in diameter? Then you realize all these facets of knowledge around here that you don't know. You see, the more you learn, the more you realize how ignorant you really are. If you only know this little bit, you don't even have any idea about how ignorant you are of this stuff, because you don't even know that this stuff out here even exists. Someone else? Okay, the question is, do I encourage involvement in homeschool groups? My answer to that is maybe. I remember that when we first were homeschooling, there were some homeschool groups, and we were involved a little bit. And, you know, the children would go with the homeschool group to maybe to a dairy operation where they were processing milk or whatever. But you know what happened? They'd come back from that, and they'd say, you know, we should go there as a family. I thought that was interesting. In other words, their unity as a family was so delightful to them that it would have been more fun if we had gone as a family to that thing than if they were going to this homeschool group as a thing. That taught me something. And also, in spite of the fact that many homeschoolers are more interested in what's right than the general average population, many of those children are not well behaved. So you go to a homeschool group, and I'm embarrassed to even be there with these other homeschoolers who are ripping and raring and doing things at the dairy that I wouldn't want my children to be doing. It's a poor testimony. So for some of those reasons, I'm not particularly interested in going with a homeschool group to some of those kind of functions. If you have lots of children like we did, you have a big enough group to do lots of things anyway. So that really wasn't an issue with us. And we found that in general, being involved in a homeschool group was not that helpful to us personally. But it depends on the stage people are at, you know. If you go, see, again, be flexible. Don't bind yourself one way or the other. If you feel like, you know, if I could go and interact with some other mothers and fathers at a homeschool group and get some ideas and once a month do this and that, and you find that's profitable, well, then praise the Lord. But then maybe the composition of the homeschool group changes and then you find it isn't profitable, then you can drop out of it. So I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. Okay, the question is, if you want to avoid busy work and avoiding workbooks, and then how do you get into their heads things about punctuation and spelling and those kind of things? We do use some materials for spelling. Rhoda talked about that some this morning. But our goal is to have them, you know, if you read a lot, you learn a lot of those things by osmosis. You learn something about spelling by how you've seen these words so many times. In other words, you learn a lot of these things without having to have a special little class on this stuff. You learn that you know automatically that at the beginning of a sentence you have a capital letter. I mean, if you read a lot, that's just an obvious thing. And I think that, it reminds me a little bit. Rochelle wrote us a note back from Nigeria, and she's talking about, you know, this tribal language that she's learning and getting ready to translate and all that. And she said, what you have to do is you have to immerse yourself in the culture and in the language to the point where you can see it, you can feel it, you can taste it. And you taste this language and you have the nuance, you know the flavor of all these prepositions and stuff, and so you know what it all means. See? And so the more you do that in your mother tongue, the more you immerse yourself in the language written by great writers, people who are very skilled in writing, who can say things in a graphic manner that rivets your attention. The more the child's writing is going to emulate that kind of thing. But the more you have them reading stuff that's written by these lackluster writers that have never read anything themselves and are just trying to churn out something for people to read, the more they're going to write just like that. You know, have you seen in church papers or periodicals, you know, a poem that's written? And The only thing that can even hope to classify it as a piece of poetry is it happens to rhyme at the end of the lines. People think that that's what poetry is. That is not what poetry is. There is lots of poetry that doesn't rhyme at all. Hebrew poetry doesn't rhyme at all. It's not the issue. The issue in poetry is pictures. It's metaphors. It's a portrayal of something in compact language. And so the issue is not primarily rhyming, even though that can be used. But if all they read is that kind of pseudo-poetry, then they're going to write those same kind of worthless poems. Okay, the question is, do you have guidelines for guarding your children when they go to the public library because of, like, for example, pictures? Well, obviously, there are pornographic things in a public library that you want to guard your child against. When I was referring to pictures before, I was basically referring to art. If you have art that's good and well done and realistic, that's going to be the kind of drawing they try to emulate rather than this sloppy art that you see in so many modern books. But when Rhoda takes the children to the library, they can pick out books that they want. And then the younger ones, she thumbs through them quickly to see, is this a good book or not? And some of them she rejects. And as they grow in maturity in that process, in other words, that becomes an educational process in them learning how to discern what is good material and what isn't. I mean, some people, it's almost like, well, I don't want my child to go to the public library because there's bad stuff there. Well, where's the end of that? When they get to be 21, what are you going to do? Are you going to run around buying all their books for them and sticking them in their house so that they don't have to go anywhere and buy any? That isn't going to work. You see, we've got to have a notion like we're going to help our child learn how to be wise, not a monkey see, monkey do kind of mentality. If you just follow the rules Dad made up, then you're going to be fine, but instead teach them wisdom. That takes spiritual discernment. There isn't a hard and fast rule that you can make. I mean, maybe here's a book that has great lessons in it and great insight, and it's great literature, but the major character smokes a pipe. And you know what? There are a lot of people that will throw that book out just because of that. Well, you know what? If you'd be consistent, you'd throw the Bible out too. Because the major character in the book of 2 Samuel committed adultery and murdered the woman's husband. Didn't he? That seems worse than smoking a pipe. You know, I think we've got to be realistic about this. We've got to guard our children and we've got to teach them discernment and wisdom. And we do that by having them with us, and when things come up, it's not that you just take them to a pornography magazine and say, see this? This is the kind of thing you don't want to look at. Not that, but you know, things come up, and then when they come up, you deal with them, and you have the privilege of being there and helping them see that, look, this is not the way to go, this is the way to go. Okay, the question is, what about scheduling? And I would say that illustrates the point. One of the reasons for having math first is because math, in a sense, math takes the most strenuous intellectual effort. You have to think in abstraction. And the higher you go in math, it's more and more abstract. And so you have to think in abstractions. It takes more effort. That takes a lot more effort than reading a story about Daniel Boone. So put that first while they have their minds uncluttered and while they aren't a little bit weary. And then after they've gone through that, then they can read about Daniel Boone. Now, In regards to scheduling, you know, we spend a lot of time on the road. For example, we're leaving the 2nd of September and we'll get home sometime mid or latter November. We'll travel probably 15,000 miles or more during that trip, visit about 20 and 30 churches. Well, that sort of interferes with your ordinary school schedule. But we take our books along, and at the same time, you flex things around. So your schedule, you know, it's not that you're religiously rigid with your scheduling. But then there are geographical opportunities as you go by and so on. So, you know, one of the great things about homeschool is you can flex it around and have it advantageous for the ultimate good without being bound to some rigid thing. And yet you can use some schedule things to give you an advantage when it's useful. Well, we've certainly enjoyed being here with you these days and wish you the Lord's blessing as you endeavor to train your children.